From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet hip-hop artist and actor Mos Def. His latest CD, The New Danger, is up for a Grammy, and his performance in the HBO movie Something the Lord Made is nominated for a Golden Globe. Now Mos Def co-stars in the new film The Woodsman as a cop keeping tabs on a child molester just released from prison. Also, we talk with Dan Morgenstern. He's been an important figure in jazz as a critic, magazine editor, and director of the Rutgers University Institute of Jazz Studies. His essays and liner notes are finally collected in a new book. It's called Living with Jazz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. military leaders say they believe a suicide bomber caused the explosion that killed 22 people yesterday at a U.S. military base near Mosul, Iraq. General Richard Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said it's difficult to protect bases against attackers who are willing to kill themselves.
The way you prevent this is you win the war against the extremists.
The attacker killed 13 American soldiers, 5 U.S. civilian contractors, and 3 Iraqi security workers. Military officials at the scene thought yesterday that the explosion might have been caused by a rocket or mortar, but a guerrilla group known as Ansar al-Sunnah claimed it was a suicide bombing. FBI agents have flown to the scene from Baghdad in an effort to determine how the bomber may have evaded base security. A major U.S. contractor has terminated its reconstruction contract in Iraq, saying soaring security costs and other problems have made it too hard to get the work done. NPR's Kathleen Schalk reports.
Contract and its partners landed a $325 million award to construct new roads, bridges, and transportation terminals in Iraq. But its work sites and headquarters came under attack and projects ground to a halt. U.S. officials say the canceled contract won't slow Iraq's reconstruction. The work will be rebid, and in the meantime, government officials are supervising contract's subcontractors. But Peter Singer of the Brookings Institution says contract's decision is significant.
It's the precedent that it sets more than anything else that worries me. It opens the doorway for others to also pull out completely.
He says up until now, major U.S. contractors have dealt with the violence by merely suspending operations. Kathleen Schalk, NPR News, Washington.
The Forest Service finalized rules for the nation's 155 national forests today. The changes give forest supervisors more leeway to approve logging and other commercial development without lengthy environmental reviews. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The rules were last updated in the 1970s, and Forest Service officials have long complained that detailed environmental analysis has paralyzed their ability to function. Forest supervisors say they spend more time making sure they don't get sued than managing the land. The new plan gives them more discretion to approve logging, drilling, and mining operations without having to do lengthy environmental impact statements. Environmentalists have opposed the new rules since they were first floated, saying there's no need to replace the wildlife safeguards and public involvement that's been part of the process for decades. They also point out that the new rules water down a requirement that forests be managed to protect threatened and endangered species. The rules will take effect once they're published in the Federal Register next week. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News.
In stocks, the Dow gained 56 points to close at 10,816. The Nasdaq was up 6 to 2157. This is NPR News. The Washington State Supreme Court ruled today that hundreds of accidentally uncounted ballots should be included in the hand recount of the state's gubernatorial race. The votes come from Seattle's King County, which is predominantly Democratic, so the additional votes could tip the close race toward Democrat Christine Gregoire. In the first recount, Republican Dino Rossi won by a very slim margin. State Democrats now say that even without the belatedly discovered ballots, Gregoire had won the race by just 8 votes out of 2.9 million cast. Republicans are conducting their own analysis. The Russian space program is preparing for a critical rocket launch early Friday. A robot cargo ship carries food for the crew of the International Space Station, where supplies are running dangerously low. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
The automated cargo craft, called a progress ship, is scheduled to dock with the space station on Christmas Day. If there's a failure and the vehicle is lost, NASA astronaut Leroy Chow and cosmonaut Salazan Sharapov may have to abandon the orbiting outpost within a month. The two-member crew has been cutting back on the size of their meals on the space station to make their dwindling food supplies last. Food deliveries on the two previous cargo ships had to be cut back to make room for critical equipment to purify the air. NASA's been dependent on Russian-built spaceships to carry supplies and crew members to and from the station following the Columbia accident. The shuttles are scheduled to fly again, but not before spring of next year. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins, Orlando.
Two French journalists returned home today after being held captive in Iraq for more than 4 months. President Jacques Chirac and some top cabinet members greeted Christian Chéneau and Georges Malbruno at a military airport outside Paris. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from T. Rowe Price, focusing on using independent research to find investment opportunities. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. Online at TRoePrice.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mos Def first became known as a hip-hop artist, then as an actor. He's doing quite well as both. He's nominated for a Golden Globe for his performance in the HBO movie Something the Lord Made, and he's nominated for a Grammy for his latest CD, The New Danger. In a Rolling Stone review, Tom Moon praised The New Danger for broadening the hip-hop palette without sacrificing or selling out its core ideals. Here's a track from it.
My hometown, break down a little history for you. Murder Broadway, Roosevelt Projects, Marcy Projects. Listen, I stepped on the field from no league, just home team. I jumped out the stands and I snatched the rock. With the final seconds dwindling on the clock, most post up to throw up the tie-breaking shot. I put it through the net and let the world's jaw drop. Then fled the arena before they called cops. Tell the players and the coach I wasn't trying to blow spot. The way they was balling made it difficult to watch. I was taught when it's something you could change around. Keep quiet, you got nothing to complain about. You got work to do. I don't know if that worked for you, but that's how most work you do. And my work is personal. I'm a working person. I put in work. I work with purpose. I get it there on the water, air, the surface.
That's Mos Def. He's also been in the films Monsters Ball and The Italian Job. He served as host, music supervisor, and co-executive producer for the HBO series Deaf Poetry, and was a writer, producer, and actor on the MTV sketch comedy series Lyricist Lounge. He co-starred in the Broadway production of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Top Dog Underdog. Now Mos Def co-stars in the new film The Woodsman. Kevin Bacon plays Walter, a convicted child molester who has just come out of prison and is trying to fit back into the world, struggling to resist his own impulses. Mos Def plays a police detective who keeps tabs on Walter, dropping in on him occasionally to make sure he's staying away from children. In this scene, the detective is talking to Walter about how despicable child molesters are.
Some of these guys, they walk right in the family's house. Very, very ballsy. I had this one guy, he's on death row, call him Henry. And he's telling me about his last victim. His little cutie named Adele. She's 7 years old. And Adele's mother's got the TV playing so loud, he can hear Letterman telling jokes in the next room. And he walks into Adele's room, puts his hand over her mouth. He says, if you scream, little girl, I'm gonna kill your mother. So of course, Adele doesn't scream, she doesn't cry, she doesn't make a sound. And Henry takes her by the hand. They walk out the front door. 10 days later, they find Adele's body, what's left of it. You believe in fairy tales?
Fairy tales?
Yeah, like Alice in Wonderland.
No.
Yeah, me neither.
I asked Mos Def about creating the character of the detective in The Woodsman.
What I was hopefully came across is the jaded, sort of hardened nature that folks in that line of work grow into. people who have to be witness to crime. And there's a certain cynicism and sarcasm. His character is there to create some real tension and pressure. You know, the hand of judgment and punishment. It's like the executioner's, you know, just knocking on your door to be like, you know, well, I could kill you, you know.
I want to congratulate you for being the first person ever to be nominated for both a Grammy Award and a Golden Globe Award at the same time. That leads me to wonder, are there big differences
for you? Am I really
the
first person ever?
Yeah, that according to this press release that I am holding in my hands, it says...
Well, you know what? I got to have that printed up on some business cards and start handing out to major D's at the local eateries because that's pretty good stuff. That's going to be awesome.
So this leads me to wonder, are they two really different worlds? The world of...
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's completely different.
Tell me about some of the differences between the world of hip-hop and the world of movies.
Well, hip-hop is just an idiom. You know, I guess I feel the same way about hip-hop that Johnny Cash felt about country music. It's the language or the dominant language of the culture, the generation that I come from. But hip-hop is not all that I do, but it's certainly a touchstone.
What came first for you, acting or music?
It's like, you know, what comes first, your left arm or your right arm? It's like they were, for me, from my experience, they were happening simultaneously. I was a young kid in the choir.
In church or in school?
In church.
Mm-hmm.
And in school. And, you know, when we would go for recess, I'd be in the schoolyard with my friends and my crew, and we'd be rhyming. And that continued all throughout my school career. When I was in class, rehearsing for a play, when it was time for lunch or after school, you know, it was time to write rhymes or listen to music, and it was just that seamless.
I want to play some music from your latest CD, and this is the one that's nominated for a Grammy. It's called The New Danger.
Yes.
And this CD is kind of brings together hip-hop and rock. I thought we'd play a track in which you actually sing. And,
oh, cool.
Yeah, and this is called The Beggar.
Oh, cool. Thank you. I love that song.
Yeah, I like that too. Say a little bit about the song. And
well, it's a song that I wrote with my band Blackjack Johnson. It's really organic. I mean, the drum line. We were just in the studio and Will started playing this really, that pattern. And it started as a jam session, and then everyone started playing together, and then I ran into the vocal booth and just kind of laid the lyrics down in two takes, and that was the entire song. We looked at it, we listened back to it. It was like, this is awesome. I love it just for the simple fact that, Dr. No, who's so well known for his electric guitar work, is playing such beautiful acoustic on the song, and it's just really one of those magical moments that, you know, everybody talks about having or wanting to have during a recording, and we had several of those that are on the record, and some that aren't, but that's one that I'm really proud of, and I'm glad you're playing. Thank you.
So are you saying that you didn't write the lyric until the riff was laid down and then you walked in and just did it?
Yeah, I walked in and did it. I mean, as Umi Says was a lot like that. I didn't write down the lyrics for Umi Says. I just I went in and just sang what was, right on my mind and how I was feeling at that time.
Well, Well, let's hear the best. I'm sorry.
Yeah, let's hear it. Let's hear it. It's enough yapping about it. Let's hear it, right?
Well, let's hear The Beggar from Mos Def's latest CD, The New Danger.
Woman, you know I love you. Woman, you know just how I feel. Try to tell me that you don't know. When I know you know the deal. Woman, you know I love you. Woman, you know I care. Hey, you try to say I'm running game. You try to say, baby, you don't play fair. Oh, darling, if there's any doubt in your mind, I want you to be sure.
That's Mos Def from his new CD, The New Danger. Now, you're singing on this as opposed to rapping. And also, this is a song that expresses, you know, love and vulnerability. And I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of rap and hip-hop that isn't really about vulnerability. It's about being hard. So is it... Are you glad to find ways to express a more fuller palette of emotions in your music?
Well, I think there is a lot of vulnerability in hip hop. I just think that the without sounding too much like some sort of righteous rebel or crusader, the powers that be don't let the full spectrum of the culture get airborne to be properly judged and critiqued and appreciated by the wider public. What the corporate involvement in music, period, and particularly in hip hop today, it promotes lifestyle music as opposed to music about life.
Okay. For example, there's one of the brochures or press releases for The New Danger is a wanted poster of you.
Yeah.
Is that an example of what you're talking about?
Well, that was, you know, I wanted to do, you know, something, you know, visceral. It was sort of tongue-in-cheek. I mean, in terms of art direction, I had a lot of control over that.
Did you want people to think that you were a gangster?
No, not at all, because... I'm not a gangster, but I do appreciate the energy of things that you can feel first before you can figure them out. Michael Stipe had a great quote. He said, "I wrote this whole album without my brain," and I think there's something to be said for you know, following your instinct and what you really feel on a spiritual level, on an emotional level. And I wanted to put images out that made people have an emotional and visceral relationship with everything. I didn't want people to be indifferent about it. You know, some people will like it, some people will love it, some people will hate it, but I didn't want anybody to be indifferent.
I realize you were kind of in on having the Wanted poster to advertise your latest CD, but does that reinforce the whole kind of like gangster lifestyle?
Not at all.
Connection.
I mean,
of rap
music? It was tongue in cheek with the, you know, I hadn't come out with an album in 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and there was a lot of you know, buzz in the street about, like, you know, we want this record.
Right. And, right.
When I did Susan Lori's play After Top Dog at the Public Theater, since I can't say the title of it,
right.
certain media outlets, there was a wanted poster of my character, and you know, he was a hunted character, and he was also loved by his mother. So wanted, it appealed to me because it had double meanings. You know, wanted is wanted, you know, loved or feared. And as a black person in America, you know, those dynamics are a daily part of black people's lives. So it's not the reinforcement or the promotion of gangster, you know, lifestyle, you know. Anything like that. I thought it was just cool, and you know, to be perfectly frank, just edgy, sexy. You know, I'm not averse to like a dose of boldness or danger. I think it keeps things interesting.
My guest is actor and hip hop artist Mos Def. He co-stars in the new movie The Woodsman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is hip-hop artist and actor Mos Def. He's nominated for a Grammy and a Golden Globe. He co-stars in the new movie, The Woodsman. What was the music you grew up with?
Everything. You know, from church hymns to rock radio to hip-hop, of course, to, you know, dancehall and reggae and everything. I love music.
What was in your parents' record collection that exposed you to music you might not otherwise have heard?
Well, my parents weren't really, you know, huge record collectors, my mother or my father. My dad was a lifelong musician. He played piano, still does, sang in Newark Boys Choir. And he and a close friend of his, educator, had a group called Voices of the Folk and performed all of the you know, early work songs and slave songs and the chain gang songs and things like this. And when I was a young boy, you know, I learned all of these songs, and as I got older, you know, they let me perform with them. So everything that I learned about music, my relationship to American music, comes from that. You know, because so much of that is really like the genesis of blues and rock and roll and everything else that we know and love and misunderstand today. So I count that as like my musical education, of those songs. But I just had a curious mind, you know. I used to go to record shops, and whatever cover art appealed to me, I go, or what titles appealed to me, I pick them up and I'd listen, and that's how I, you know.
That's great.
Spend a lot of my allowance.
what's one or two of the more unusual or ridiculous records you ended up buying solely because you like the cover art?
I had great success. I never was really disappointed. I mean, I brought Brilliant Corners
by Thelonious Monk. Yeah, uh-huh.
Because it was that five-sided picture.
Uh-huh.
I bought Well, of course, every Miles Davis album that I could get. And I bought people and names that I was curious about that I hadn't heard. I wanted to know who John Coltrane was. I wanted to know who Miles Davis. I did a lot of you know, research on my own as a teenager, just listening to these people for myself. It's like someone telling you, you know, you got to go get this book. So I went to the library and checked out these books.
What led you toward jazz? Since it sounds like I know you were listening to everything, but certainly what your friends were mostly listening to was probably, you know, rap and hip hop, and that was probably what you were listening to on the radio. So what led you toward jazz?
It just always been around, you know my uncles and you know, elders in my community would turn it on, and it appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I heard it on the radio, I remember listening to BGO. It appealed to me, the images of those men like Miles or Dexter Gordon, or they just appealed to me. I guess it's the same reason that, you know, people that I picked up on rock and roll, because, you know, Jimi Hendrix is Dylan, or, you know, anyone else that, you know, any of the legends, or, you know, just seminal iconic figures are very attractive spokesmen for the music. So you become interested on the basis that, you know, this collection of personalities or just figures. And that's what jazz was to me. It was this strange, attractive new world for me to go into. And I just dove in. I wanted to know. And I didn't come with any sort of expectations. I didn't know if it would be something that I liked at all, but I gave it a shot, and I loved it.
Mos Def co-stars on the new movie The Woodsman. His latest CD is called The New Danger. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
See me, touch me, give me, want me, feed me, walk me, touch me, love me. This old world is cold and ugly. What we are is low and lovely. I am the most beautiful boogeyman. The most beautiful boogeyman. Let me be your favorite nightmare. Close your eyes and I'll be right there wide open. Oh.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, A New Vision of the American Forest, by photographer James Balog. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Falling in Love with the Beat. More with rapper and actor Mos Def. And we talk with Dan Morgenstern, who has made his mark in jazz as a critic, editor, and director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. His reviews, essays, and liner notes are collected in the new book, Living with Jazz.
I should take a notion to jump into the ocean. Tain't nobody's business if I do, 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 do. Rather than persecute me, choose that you would shoot me, 'cause tain't nobody's business if I do. You can talk, you can rave, they can say awful things about me. I don't care what you say, go on your way if you doubt me. 'Cause if I go to church on Sunday and tear it down on Monday, tain't nobody's business if I do. I mean it, I solid mean it.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor and hip-hop artist Mos Def. He co-stars in the new movie The Woodsman. In addition to his music and acting careers, he co-owns a bookstore in Brooklyn that's also a community cultural center. His co-owner is Talib Kweli, who was also Mos Def's partner in the hip-hop group Black Star. Here they are on their 1998 CD. Reciting my quotes while R&B singers hit bad notes. We rock the boat of thought that my man Lewis statements just provoke. Caught up in conversations of our personal worth. Brought up through endangered species status on the planet Earth. Survival tactics means busting gaps to prove you hard. Your firearm are too short to box with God. Without faith, all of that is illusionary. Raise my son, no vindication of manhood necessary. Not strong, only aggressive. Not free, we only licensed. Not compassionate, only polite. Now who the nicest? Not good, but we'll behave. Chasing after death so we could call ourselves brave. Still living like mental slaves. Hiding like thieves in the night from life. Illusions of oasis making you look twice. Hiding like thieves in the night from life. Illusions of oasis making you look twice. I'm sure that everybody out listening agree that everything you see ain't really how it be. A lot of jokers out running in place, chasing the style. Be a lot going on beneath the empty smile. Most cats in my area be loving a hysteria. Synthesized surface conceals the interior. America, land of opportunity, mirages and camouflages more than usually. Speaking loudly, saying nothing, you confusing me, you losing me. Your game is twisted, want me enlisted. And your usury, foolishly, most men join the ranks cluelessly, but foolishly accept the deception. A lot of performers who are extraordinarily charismatic on stage are actually really shy in public life. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you were ever like that too, if you were ever...
I was painfully shy.
Really?
As a child. Like, uh-huh. You know, with like physical symptoms, a tightness in the chest, and just it was very, very... shy as a child. And you know, I wanted to make a connection with, you know, the rest of the world, but I was just, you know, very reserved and not quite sure how to do that. And it's all worked out perfectly. You know, I don't regret a minute of it.
Is there something that you felt you could tap into when you were in front of the mic or on stage that you couldn't quite tap into when you were just on your own without the benefit of the mic or the stage?
Well, the mic didn't even get involved. I mean, you know, I was a child. I was 9 years old, you know. And rhyming was a way for me to interact with my community. And it was a special skill that everybody around me didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
As I got older, I just enjoyed it more. I started getting better at it, and I started to have creative ambitions. I wanted to be able to say in rhymes the things. I wanted to be able, you know, when I was in high school, I started reading a lot of, you know, Chinua Achebe and, you know, Harold Pinter and, you know, Arthur Rimbaud, and, you know, someone gave me a copy of Illuminations, and that had a deep impact on me. Just different authors that I loved, and I wanted to be able to be as descriptive in a rhyme as some of my favorite novelists, the playwrights, were in their work. And that became what I want, my aim, what I wanted to be able to do, to be able to be, you know, stylistic and to be able to flow and be clever and all of those sorts of things that I love about hip-hop, and also be literal and have a emotional impact. The same emotional impact that, you know, that writers that I loved had on me.
Now, tell me a little bit more about your childhood, where you grew up. You grew up in Brooklyn?
Yes.
What was the neighborhood like?
Well, I was born in Downstate Hospital in Flatbush, and I was raised in Bedford-Stuyvesant and in Roosevelt Projects. And then when I was 9 to 10, moved back to Flatbush. And I'm a Brooklyn resident to this day. And I love my city. I feel blessed and lucky to have been born in a magical place on earth called Brooklyn.
What makes Brooklyn magical to you?
Well, I mean, everything. I mean, you know, Walt Whitman working at the Brooklyn Eagle.
Is that a newspaper, the Brooklyn Eagle?
The Brooklyn Eagle was a abolitionist paper in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. It's just rich with history.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the New York experience on a very homegrown level. It's not metropolitan New York, and it's family-based. People who have been there, people who are there, have been there for a very long time. You know, myself included in my family. So it's home in every sense of the word. And it's just got dynamic things. I mean, from the bridge to the Brooklyn Children's Museum, the first children's museum in the world.
I used to go on class trips to that museum.
Fantastic places in Brooklyn. The library, the botanical garden, Prospect Park. It's so much there. I mean, I could go on and on and on.
Now, among the things that you do, among your talents, is that you also play instruments.
Yes.
Several of them. Bass, vibes, keyboards, percussion?
Yeah, I play bass, drums, keys. I can figure my way out on most instruments. I'm not good with any wind instruments at all. I tried to play the trumpet, and I quickly gave that up.
You know, a lot of people worry that because rap so often samples music, as opposed to having live musicians playing behind them, that...
I think that's a misconception.
Do you? Because a lot of people worry that young people aren't learning instruments anymore.
Because the Sugar Hill Gang is the seminal. I mean, there is no hip-hop without them, and that was a proper session band as much as the Muscle Shoals session band or the Motown session band, all of those... Curtis Blow records, all of those Sugar Hill records that people hear are live musicians playing. The element of sampling is actually a phenomenon of the budgetary cutbacks in the school system. And when I was in public school as a grade schooler, and there were music programs that were there and that just mysteriously disappeared. And that creative impulse was still in the community, but there was no outlet for it. There were no places for young people to go to learn to play instruments, and parents could not afford to even do that for their children. So this generation made do with what was available, which was their parents' records, and they made their own songs or versions of those songs, because that was all that there was available. Nobody was saying, play this or play that. And in the mix of all of that, there was still a lot of music. What that created was it created connoisseurs. It created these young people who were becoming knowledgeable about music via the advent of sampling. So you would go to a guy's house, and these guys have hundreds and hundreds and sometimes thousands. I know guys with thousands of records from everywhere, of every stripe and variation that you can imagine, because they're all, as Africa Vambaataa said, looking for the perfect beat, wherever that may be. And I've heard some of the most fantastic, exotic, obscure, amazing music in the basements and homes of hip-hop producers. And sampling is not as easy as people would imagine. But, you know, to quote Fidel Castro, had a great quote after he was captured in his first attempt to overthrow Batista. He's in his prison cell. He said, "History will absolve me." So whatever misconceptions that people have about the culture or its origins, before it's all done, people will understand it clearly. And I'm confident in that.
Well, listen, I want to congratulate you again on the Grammy and the Golden Globe nominations, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Mos Def co-stars in the new film The Woodsman. His latest CD is called The New Danger. Coming up, Dan Morgenstern, director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. His reviews and essays are finally collected in a new book. This is Fresh Air. After writing about jazz for over 40 years, critic Dan Morgenstern finally has a book collecting his essays, reviews, and liner notes. It's called Living with Jazz, A Reader. In the New York Times Book Review, Alfred Appel wrote that Living with Jazz deserves to be on the short shelf of essential books on the music. Morgenstern has been an important figure as a critic, editor, and historian. During the 60s and early 70s, he edited Downbeat, and before that, he edited the magazine Metronome. Since 1976, he's been the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, one of the world's largest archival collections of jazz materials. Morgenstern was born in Vienna, where his father was the cultural correspondent for a German newspaper and had written critically of the Nazis. After the Nazis took over Austria, Morgenstern's father fled Vienna, but the young Morgenstern had scarlet fever and was too sick to travel. After recovering, he and his mother found safety in Copenhagen and then Sweden. The family reunited in New York after the war. I asked Morgenstern about his introduction to jazz as a child during World War II.
What got me, really got me involved, was seeing Fats Waller in Copenhagen in September of 1938. And, you know, that was a great experience. I had never seen anybody like that before. Well, there wasn't anybody like Fats Waller. You know. There never has been since. But he was so, you know, so vital and so overpowering in a way, you know, but he was physically very large. I had not seen many black people in my life before then, and he was, as he would say, mesmerizing.
Would you choose a record that you loved when you were young, during the war, when you were fleeing from the Nazis, a record that still means a lot to you?
Well, I guess, you know, this is, of course, a kid's record, but it's also, in retrospect, it's a good jazz record. That was Chick Webb's Dipsy Doodle, which featured a vocal by the then still very young, about 19-year-old Ella Fitzgerald. And then after the vocal, it had a tremendous trombone solo by Sandy Williams, whom I subsequently got to know after I came to this country. And that was just a record that I loved, and I particularly liked, you know, the nonsense lyrics. I knew some English, but not really a lot, but it has sort of silly lyrics, you know, and then that trombone solo afterwards. It was, you know, that's a record that I'm still very fond of.
Why don't we hear it?
The Dipsy Doodle is easy to find. It's almost always in the back of your mind. You never know it until it's too late. And then you're in such a terrible state. Like the moon jumped over the cowhead diddle. That's the way the Dipsy Doodle works. When you think that you're crazy, you're the victim of the Dipsy Doodle. But it's not your mind that's hazy. It's your tongue that is fault, not your noodle. Ready to ready to ready old noodle. Dip, 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 dipsy doodle. You think you're crazy, the things that you say. Like rhythm got I and hot am I. That's the way the dipsy doodle works.
Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald, The Dipsy Doodle, a record that meant a lot to Dan Morgenstern when he was growing up, and now jazz critic, historian, and director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, Dan Morgenstern has a new collection of his writings, which is called Dan Morgenstern, Living with Jazz. In 1947, after the war, you and your mother moved to New York, where your father had already moved. What are some of your earliest memories of discovering jazz as a New Yorker and actually being able to go to concerts and go to record stores?
Well, I have this line that I've used a lot. I used it in my very subliminal appearance on Ken Burns' Jazz, which I had the pleasure of. I was an advisor to that, but on screen I only appeared for about 10 seconds. But what I said is something that I've often said, which is that when I came to New York, you know, what I wanted was not to see the Empire State Building, but I wanted to see 52nd Street. 52nd Street, after all, was alive at night, you know, and I was still only 17, but I managed to get there, and to me, it was, you know, it was paradise. I mean, you could, one side of the street, you could hear Sidney Bechet, and across the street, you could hear Charlie Parker, and Billie Holiday was next door, you know, I mean, it was just an incredible place.
You've described yourself as having been more of a jazz journalist and jazz proselytizer than jazz critic. Would you choose a record that you feel you you helped affect the destiny of, or helped change the attitude toward, a record that you loved that you thought wasn't really getting adequate attention, or wasn't really understood?
Well, one of the things that I found irksome was the attitude that then existed towards the work of Louis Armstrong. You know, people had a tendency to look at it in terms of the Hot Five era, you know, heebie-jeebies, and then jump to the All-Stars and Hello, Dolly. And everything in between was sort of being ignored. And to me and others as well, that was the, you know, some of the peak achievements of Mr. Armstrong. So in particular, I had a chance to do liner notes for a collection of wonderful material from the mid-30s that had more or less been neglected. And in particular, one thing that was on there was a piece by Armstrong himself called Swing That Music, which is just a wonderful demonstration of his awesome trumpet prowess, and also kind of reminded me in the way he punches out 42 high C's, you know, after the vocal, reminded me of the way Joe Louis punched out Max Schmeling. And I think I was able to bring that into better focus and kind of illuminate that aspect of Armstrong's artistry. And I'm happy about that.
Well, why don't we hear that Armstrong recording of Swing That Music, and this is from 1936?
Right.
My heart gives a chill, I feel such a thrill, my feet won't keep still when they swing that music. Rhythm like that puts me in a trance, or you can't blame me for wanting to dance. From what I understand, it must be just grand to play in a band. When they swing that music, I'm just happy as can be. When they swing that music for me. Thank you.
That's Louis Armstrong. We'll hear more from Dan Morgenstern after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dan Morgenstern. Since 1976, he's directed the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. His reviews, liner notes, and essays are finally collected in a book. It's called Living with Jazz. Since 1976, you've directed the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. And in that sense, you've become really important as a collector of jazz history. I mean, the Institute is, I don't know, perhaps the most important collection of jazz history in the country, one of the most important in the world. What are one or two of the objects in the collection of the Institute of Jazz Studies that mean the most to you and that have an almost like magical aura surrounding them?
Well, I think that would be the instruments. We have quite a collection of instruments that belong to famous and maybe even not so famous musicians, and some of those people were people that I felt very close to. So those things represent a very tangible, you know, aspect of my own life with this music, such as, you know, Ben Webster's tenor, Lester Young's tenor, the one he used when he was with Basie, and we have odd things like plastic gardenia of Billie Holiday's when she couldn't get a real one, you know, she used that. And Billie was somebody that I just absolutely loved. And manuscript, we have a wonderful manuscript by Louis Armstrong, and we have, I don't know if I can use the expression tchotchkes, but we have things like we have an Ella Fitzgerald, a little sculpture made of spoons and forks, which actually represents her, you know, with a microphone in her hand. And that was sitting on her mantelpiece. She really liked that. And those things are special, you know. They have an aura.
One of the things that's interesting about your book is that it not only, you know, helps put jazz musicians in perspective and shares your critical views of them. There's some interesting personal history in it as you, you know, review various concerts and records, and you're there at the moment these things are happening. And I thought I'd just read an excerpt of something you wrote about Ornette Coleman after seeing him in concert in 1958. So this is very early on in an Ornette Coleman's career. And I'm just going to excerpt a paragraph here. You write, "Whatever else Ornette Coleman may be, one cannot doubt the sincerity of his music. It is fiercely individualistic and makes no concessions to conventions, not even to those of modern jazz. That he takes his cue from Charlie Parker is unquestionable, but this is no imitator. Coleman's cohorts are obviously in full sympathy with his aims, and the unison work between his alto and Don Cherry's miniature cornet is thrilling because it sounds so free, yet obviously requires the greatest discipline." Then you go on to say, "The boys are serious, but not in the professional and vastly annoying manner of Miles Davis. There are occasional smiles, and what do you know? At the end of the set, Ornette Coleman makes an announcement in traditional style. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And now we present the great Benny Golson Art Farmer Jazz Tet. Let's bring them on with a hand." I thought that was so funny that you're reviewing this like new controversial avant-gardist. And what catches your attention as well as the music is the fact that he's this real gentleman on the bandstand. And very traditional in the way he welcomes on, you know, Art Farmer.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason why I did that was, you know, at the time a lot of people were jumping on Ornette, you know, and he was really, you know, it was a storm of controversy, but nobody said that, you know, and I felt that was my impression the first time I saw them at the Five Spot, you know, that there was something really engagingly, you know, I wouldn't say unsophisticated, but unspoiled, you know. And this was the first time in New York, you know, and that was very, in some ways, very appealing. But, you know, I think maybe I was the only one who, you know, who mentioned that. The other people were much too busy, you know, analyzing the music or trying to do that.
Well, Dan Morgenstern, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Dan Morgenstern directs the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. His new book is called Living with Jazz, A Reader. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by the Art Ensemble of Chicago. It's the track Dan Morgenstern picked when I asked him about music he changed his mind about and came to love.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Purple Book 2005 edition, the definitive guide to exceptional online shopping by Hilary Mendelson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Harold McGee has a new edition of his popular book on food and cooking about the scientific principles that explain why foods behave the way they do. On the next Fresh Air, McGee offers some scientific tips for holiday cooking. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.